Today's program deals with lessons from a difficult person, and I'm going to be talking with Sarah Ellison. And we're going to talk about, at least partially during this interview, about how difficult people relate to people with problems of addiction. And so as we get into that, we'll be discussing, are difficult people all addicted? Are all addicted people difficult? What's the correlation there? The funny thing was that Sarah Ellison never realized that she was a difficult person, someone who harangued people until she got her way through snip fits and temper tantrums, talked over her bosses, and pointed out what she thought were their misconceptions. In her family, where she felt bullied, the only way that she knew how to get someone's attention and approval was to voice her opinion and loudly. Without standing her ground, how could she do what she thought was best for herself and everyone else around her? She wasn't intentionally mean-spirited. She was just trying to do what she thought was right. And that was until a kind but firm boss woke her up. With great compassion and strength, her boss pointed out that her actions had consequences. That in being difficult, she was not only disrupting the office camaraderie and production, but impeding her own professional advancement. And that's the beginning of Sarah's transformation. It's good to have Sarah Ellison on the program today. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm great. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Okay, so you didn't know what that you were a difficult person. How did you find a difficult person?
How did I find out that I was a difficult
person? How do you define?
Well, Lord have mercy, you know, it's different from every person. I think there are some characteristics that difficult people have, but I would say that anybody that is driving you crazy, that you have to be around for very long. I mean, you can see someone fleetingly, like in a grocery store line or waiting to go to a movie or something, and you think, wow, I'm glad I don't have to live with that person, or, you know, you might have a negative reaction, but you wouldn't spend a lot of time on it. But if you have a family member or a colleague who, for whatever reason, is driving you crazy, or you perceive that what they're doing is driving you crazy, then you call them difficult.
Sure.
I know that's not exactly the answer you're expecting. There are some what I call toxic habits, which I learned from William Glasser, that get in the way of relationships. And usually difficult people are, they would include these habits or some of them in their behavior. And they're, you know, criticizing, blaming, complaining, nagging, threatening, punishing, bullying, bribing, rewarding to control. That kind of behavior is usually, I'm not saying that somebody would exhibit all of them, but any of those behaviors, if we have to be around them for very long, we have to work next to them or with them, it's not much fun, and people get labeled difficult.
Well, in my review of addictive behaviors, one of them that is fairly common is negative thinking. And that takes in a full range of different kinds of things. And I would say that negative thinkers are difficult people, so I'm wondering, is a difficult person always an addicted person, in your opinion?
I wouldn't be able to answer that because I don't know everybody. I know that many of the people that I know in recovery have characteristics before they're in recovery, sometimes even afterwards, but they have characteristics that would be considered difficult by others. But I couldn't say that everyone who is addicted is a difficult person. I'm not sure that would serve me in any way.
Yeah, well, I think never or always are probably not things that we can get on board with, but I was just talking about, you know, in the majority. So, in your opinion, can we change an addict or difficult person? And I know that with respect to at least the difficult person, that's in your book. Tell us about that.
Well, what I have in the book, or the reason I wrote the book, was because when my boss kindly and politely and emphatically was able to point out to me that what I was doing was bugging other people, one of the key messages here is that I had no idea that I was doing it. And I think more than anything else, difficult people are not aware of what they're doing. So the reason I wrote the book was I sort of thought, gee whiz, you know, I'm not a young woman. I'm pretty mature here. How come no one ever told me? And I wrote the book to help. Well, I started doing workshops, and then I wrote the book to go along with the workshop to help people who have difficult people in their lives work through a process so that they can have that conversation with them, as my boss did with me, earlier rather than later, because difficult people usually end up having difficult relationships, and we need relationships, and so if we're difficult, we're not enjoying it, and the people with whom we have relationships don't enjoy it. So I'm not saying that we can change a difficult person, but if you work through the exercises in my book, they are self-discovery, self-exploring exercises around your own attitudes and your own beliefs, and whether you can look at the difficult person in a less negative way, if you can start some of that positive thinking about them, then it's possible that you can have a conversation. And the model that I give you for a conversation could lead to change if you're willing to listen to their response, because it's going to be denial or anger or both, or blaming someone else, or who knows what it is. But rarely do you have the experience that my boss had, which was, I mean, I just sat down in my office chair and went, oh, wow. Now, I'm not sure that I ever, you know, that I stopped having temper tantrums at that point, but I sure noticed when I got hot after that. When something really starts to bug me, I can tell from the physiology and what's coming into the tone of my voice, and I think, whoa, wait a minute, this is not the way I want to be. So I think that's my recognition of it and my acceptance of it was pretty unusual. I think it's because I was working a program of recovery to start with that I was able to hear her. I think before that, I would have had more things to blame. And if she had been able to listen to me, she was a very good communicator, and she could listen, and she used logic, but she didn't discount my emotions. Then you can invite the difficult person to change. That it's not like if you read the book, you can make the difficult person change. That isn't going to happen. But you can maybe invite them to change, and have a way of looking at them that is less frustrating for you as the individual living with or working with a difficult person.
Well, when you were a active difficult person, as opposed to a recovering difficult person,
mm-hmm.
You could be defined as having an anger management problem, could you not?
You could, yeah. I mean, but it was way much more than that. I think a lot of my experience is a lot of people who are in recovery have also developed a lot of anger. Or they may have gotten really, really depressed, which is, I think, anger turned inward. So if you study anger, go very far with anger management, you discover that people are having to do the same kind of homework that we do in recovery programs.
So,
But it wasn't, I mean, I don't think it was just an anger management problem. My particular behavior that she was able to mention to me was exhibiting itself as anger. But for example, I am relatively intelligent. I have a good education. Genetically, I've inherited the ability to sound like I know what I'm talking about. I appear to be very confident. And it would have been perfectly possible for one of my supervisors to say, you know, when you ask me questions in that tone of voice in front of the rest of the staff, I feel challenged. It feels like you're putting me on the spot. Is that what you want to do? Do you realize that's the way it comes across? That wouldn't have been an anger management thing. But I was also doing that, and it wasn't until my other boss, you know, spoke to me as she did, and I began to really look at how I was talking to people and how I was acting and interacting. I thought, oh, my God. But again, I was completely unaware of it. I knew that I didn't have the relationship with my some of my supervisors or some of my vice presidents that I would have liked, but I didn't know it was my fault.
Well, you would say that the first thing that a person could do for a difficult person is to tell them that they're difficult because they don't
know.
They don't know
what I would say. I would say the first thing you do if you have a difficult person in your life is hopefully read the book so that you can have the conversation, and there are a number of steps. So you have to be able to, take the drama. So the first thing is don't react. You take the drama out of whatever you find difficult about the other person. Can you define what they're doing in terms of the words that they use or the actions that they're taking? And that steps you back from whatever urgency or angst that you might be feeling, and it allows you to have a little, I call it putting a space around whatever the behavior is. But a lot of times people it takes some time for them to be able to describe someone's behavior as just the words that they're saying or the actions that they're taking. We spend a lot of time in our culture labeling, you know, like, oh, well, she's rude, or she's controlling, or they're manipulative, or, you know, you name it, we've got names for it, right?
Yes.
So the first step is being able to say, well, and then when people consult with me and they call and they want to talk to me about someone, my first question is, what does that look like? What does it sound like? What are the actions? And the words that are being said. And sometimes it's the tone of voice in the words, and I get that. But to try and to be able to articulate this is the first step. The second step is to think, how is it impacting me and others? Now, if it's just impacting me, then I need to look at myself pretty carefully. But if I'm aware, and I'm going to have to look at myself anyway, but if I'm aware that it's impacting clients, customers, family members, you name it, people that you volunteer with, members of the church or the synagogue, whatever group you're part of, if people are wishing that let's schedule the meeting for half an hour earlier so we get through all the business before he shows up because he always dominates, you know, that kind of thing, then you have an impact. Does this make sense?
Yes, but what kind of incentives can you give a difficult person that would make them want to change?
Well, so we're moving in that direction. Before you have the conversation to invite them to think about changing, I believe that we have to take ourselves out of the judgment seat and take ourselves away from saying this person needs to change, must change, ought to change, whatever it is that's motivating us to talk to them. We need to, that's why there's some exercises in the book where we need to clarify how much of this person is a trigger for me. Who do they remind me of? Is there a time in my past, childhood, high school, whatever, when someone else like that was either mean to me or, you know, I had an experience with, and this person reminds me of this, of the person in my past. See, that's someone who's your trigger. Well, if my reaction to the difficult person is based on a trigger from my past, I need to do some work on that myself, because it, if it's not bothering anybody else, it's really my problem. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So if other people are having the same issue, and I can see that I'm not being triggered, I mean, if other people, if there is an impact on others, and I can describe the behavior, and I'm pretty clear about the individual, the current person, the difficult person, is not triggering someone from my past, or if they are, I've worked on it, then I need to stop and decide whether I just want this person to be different because I think they should be different, because I think they should be, which means I'm in their business. If I can't really demonstrate an impact, and I'm coming from a perspective of, I just want them to be different. You know, we're none of us are God, so we aren't going to be able to invite someone to think about their behavior unless there's an impact and unless we're not in their business. So there's a whole exercises around whose business are we in. It helps to make a list of all the names we'd like to call this person, and then try to reframe those characteristics, those descriptions of that person in a positive way. And again, this kind of creates some space around around our perception of the other person. So part of telling a difficult person that maybe their behavior, maybe to invite them to change their behavior, part of the process is helping change our perception of that person. The goal is to be in their corner, to be supporting them and not being against them. And there are a number of different exercises that I suggest. But then coming to your question is, what rewards or what...
Incentives
can you offer? Here's the way the conversation works. It's I respect you for this, and I admire you for that. And I wonder if you know that every time you do this, it has this impact on me and the other staff. So my boss said to me, you're doing a terrific job. I'm really glad we're working together. Are you aware that you have this habit of festering and doing behaviors that kind of drive the rest of us crazy? And I said, no, I'm not aware. And she said, that's okay, I'll tell you the next time you do it. And I said, okay, and so she did. And it was, you can call it an anger management problem. It was me just trying to find a pair of glasses. They were very expensive. They were the first pair of glasses I'd ever bought. And I was picking papers up and dropping them, and I was stomping in and out of the office to try and find them in my car. And it was an area of cubicles, so we were pretty much enclosed with about five or six cubicles, and so it was pretty disruptive. And I had no idea I was doing it, and of course it was impacting the others. And she just said, you know, it's driving us crazy, we can't get our work done. And I said, oh, no, I didn't know I was doing it, and of course I don't want to, you know, make it an issue for everyone to get their work done. Here's the irony, or maybe it wasn't irony, maybe it was fate, but 5 years later, I found myself sharing a fairly large office with a gentleman who did the exact same thing. We each had, you know, our workspaces in opposite corners, and he was creating a document that was going to list all the activities for a month, and he was trying to get all his papers straight and get it right on the computer, and I just sat there and I didn't say a word. I just laughed to myself because he did exactly the same thing. He was picking things up and dropping them, and he was muttering to himself, and he was opening drawers and slamming them and just, you know, generally being a little whirling dervish in his corner. And I thought, you know what? This is what I did. And I never said a word to him for a number of reasons. One, you know, it was the right moment, not when he was in the middle of it. And also because I was the only person that was being affected. And I got it. I got it as it was a lesson for me. But what my boss said to me was, do you know you're doing it? Is that what you know, and you're making it hard for us to work. Is that what you want? So your goal in terms of having the conversation is to say, hey, John, did you know that when you do this, it has this impact on the clients, or this is the feedback we get from the residents when you use that tone of voice with them, or when you push their wheelchair so fast, or whatever. You know, it has this impact. Do you know you're doing it? And they say, well, yeah, I thought I was supposed to. Are you aware that it's having a negative impact? Is that what you want? Now, hear it carefully, because I'm not saying you gotta change. I'm just saying, are you aware you're doing it? And is the impact that it's having, is that what you want? Is that what the impact that you want? Now, the consequences are kind of implied, especially if it's a work situation and it's a supervisor talking to an employee. The unstated implication is that if you don't stop having that impact on the rest of us or on our clients or customers, you may need to look for another job. So if it's a family, then often we have to bring that up. Did you know you're having this impact? Is it what you want? And sometimes if it's like, say, the parent of teenagers is talking to her parent and saying, Mom, when you talk to them that way, they tune you out, they don't listen to you. Is that what you want? And the grandmother might say, well, they should listen to me. And that's when, if the mother's done her work, she can say, yeah, I get it. You'd like them to be more attentive. Did you know that when you use those words and you give them orders instead of asking them questions, they don't want to answer you? Are you aware of that? And is that what you want? Or if you really want to have a conversation with someone, maybe has it occurred to you to ask a question rather than give an order? That's way too fast, probably, because the grandmother is probably on a kind of a high horse about it's important that children should be seen and not heard. Who knows? I'm making that up completely. But that's the process of it. So the incentive for the difficult person has got to come from inside them. It's not an external thing. Unless it's their job. It's pretty simple to say, if you keep talking down to the customers or saying, or answering the phone when there's a human in front of you, you know, that kind of thing. My particular pet peeve if I was managing a fast food place would be to say, first you give them the change, then you give them the paper, rather than handing a dollar bill with, you know, change on top of it to the person who's driven through and paid for their food. That's just my little pet peeve, because it's very difficult to handle the change, and it slides all over the place, and it implies less respect for the purchaser.
Yes.
And to me it says, I'm so busy, I don't have time to take 30 seconds to hand you your change and then hand you your paper money. And I'm just so busy, and my time is more important than yours. And I don't think that's their intention at all, but I'm not in charge of them. I'm just giving you an example.
Today we're talking with Sarah Elliston, and her book is called Lessons from a Difficult Person. Why don't you tell us, Sarah, how the listeners can get a copy of this book so they'll know some tricks of the trade with respect to dealing with difficult people?
Well, you can go to Amazon.com and type in Lessons from a Difficult Person. It'll pop up there. Or you can go to my website, which is SarahElliston.com, and there's a place where you can buy it. If you're on Facebook, I have an author page, Sarah Elliston Author, and there's also a link there. They'll all take you to Amazon, but sometimes Sarah Ellison is easier to remember than Lessons from a Difficult Person. So the other thing is that if you go to my website, there's other information there. Some other radio interviews are linked to there. I have a blog, and if you are really interested and you give me your email address, then we will email you a couple of the pages of the workshop that I do, the first page or two of handouts that are like exercise pages for the workshop, and it also gives you the introduction to the book. So those come to you as like e-documents.
Oh, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
When you, you were talking just a minute ago about the interaction between telling some person that, did they know that they were difficult, and is that what they wanted to do, and these kind of things. It kind of brought up in my mind in addiction recovery about intervention, where family members, employers, children, whatever, get together with a person and go over their addictive behavior and try to get them in the mood to have therapy or treatment. Do you see a correlation there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the goal of each of those is the same. One is, you know, the whole gang coming together, because when you're talking about going into treatment and acknowledging that you're really powerless over whatever the addiction is, it takes a group. And I think my model, if you want to call it that, for having a conversation with a difficult person follows the same premise, which is, here's what I see you doing, here's what the impact is, and is that what you really want to be in this world? It's possible. There was one time I was working with, it's possible that a group could probably do this with an individual, but I think, especially if it's a work-related process, I think it's very touchy, because it's pretty hard to work with people if they've all gotten together as a group and said, did you know that you're doing this and it's driving us all crazy? Now, my staff, the people that I worked with, I had been working with them for quite a while, and we weren't new to each other. I was new to my boss, actually. She'd only been working there for about 3 months. But everybody else I knew pretty well, and I was able to, over the next sort of week, sort of go around from person to person and say, I want to apologize. I had no idea I was doing it, and I'll stop. I did work with an organization once, consulted with the head of human resources and the CEO of a small nonprofit. There were about 15 people on staff, and we sat and talked and walked through a potential training that I might be able to do with the staff, because there was someone that they considered very difficult on staff, and I was a little uncomfortable. I don't like to be invited to come in and fix a group of people or fix one person. It sort of makes me itch a little. But I walked her through the process, the CEO and the head of human resources. We walked through the process of the workshop and how we invite people to look at each other. We did some of the exercises. And when she called me back about 2 weeks later, she said, I don't know what you did, but the problem has pretty much resolved itself, and this woman is no longer difficult. And my response, I said, goody, that's wonderful. We don't have to do the workshop. But what my gut tells me is, because I took the time and the two individuals took the time to really look at what they were saying and thinking about this other person, and when they chose to look at her differently, guess what? She started acting differently.
Well, sir, I define addiction in my writings as when you discover that one of your behaviors is hurting you, and that could be any number of different ways, or someone you love, and you can't stop it for whatever reason, then you're addicted to that behavior.
Uh-huh.
I see a correlation there between that uh-huh. and dealing with people that you talk about as difficult. Persons.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I'd like to say, I'm not sure I said it today or not, is that I think folks who are exhibiting difficult behaviors are their habits. The one thing I always start a workshop with is your difficult person is not doing this on purpose to piss you off. It's just they're not waking up in the morning with how can I make my wife, spouse, boss, whoever angry. It's a habit. It's something they've always done. I honestly believe, and I think I share your definition of an addiction, but I think we get hooked into the addiction partially because the negative consequences haven't played out for us. Now, you know, you can overdose so many times on serious drugs, and then you hopefully will get the picture that there's a negative consequence. But what I was thinking was in terms of, oh, being negative or being a workaholic, sort of personal relationship kinds of behaviors rather than, you know, alcohol or drugs. Oh, wait a minute. Where was I going with that?
You're having a senior moment is where you're going.
You're right. I am. I think, what were we talking about?
Well,
addictions are repeated behaviors.
Addictions, like difficult people, are mm-hmm. behaviors. And mm-hmm. in order to be able to get in the mood for stopping those behaviors, first you got to know that you're doing something that's not what you think is normal or what you want to do. And then after that, with either difficult persons or addicted people, you have to have some kind of belief system that you can indeed get over it, get cured from it or whatever. So I know in my books, I put in examples and reasons why you can believe that you can cure yourself of that problem. And how do you get people to believe that they can get over being difficult? Is there something that you can say to them like, well, I didn't know it, but they told me, and I thought about it, they were right, and so I started from that day forward trying to, any time that I did this kind of behavior, to check myself on it, or what do you tell?
I haven't done that. My book is really addressing the people who live with and work with the difficult person. So there isn't any part of the book that says, at the end of the book I say, if you think you're a difficult person, and I list some characteristics, then, you know, stick around for book two, because this book was really designed for folks who have difficult people in their lives and would like them to change. And so that's the thrust of the book. So there isn't a chapter on if you think you're a difficult person. I actually am writing an article on it, and I guess my premise would be yes, that once I understand how I'm being difficult or how I'm being perceived as being difficult, definitely I worked to remedy that. But I asked for a lot of help. I mean, I said to the next two places that I worked, I said, I have a tendency to do this, and I know it's not very popular, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd call me on it if you see me doing it or you hear me doing it. And people were willing to do that because I gave them permission to do it. People have told me I'm a little unusual in that I am really open to saying, I probably screwed that up. I don't know the answer to that question. I tend to finish people's sentences sometimes, which sort of annoys them. And so call me on it. You know, if I do it, please tell me. Because it's not, I'm not doing it to be annoying.
That takes me back to when I was in Toastmasters, and mm-hmm. we were trying, all of us, to be better public speakers. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they did was, when you threw in something that wasn't necessary to be there, something to just give yourself time to think, mm-hmm. like, you know, or or something like that. Mm-hmm. Different clubs would have different ways of, like, you might ring a bell. And as you were talking, every time you heard that bell, you would know that this behavior you had just done, somebody recognized it. Mm-hmm. And I see the correlation there between being a better speaker and hopefully being a better person.
If you want to. I think where I start itching around and feeling uncomfortable is when other people think they know how the difficult person should be. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Every article I've ever read about dealing with difficult people says, well, if you have this kind of a person, do this. And if you have this kind of a person, do that. And what I'm saying is, look, the difficult person, it's a habit. They have no clue they're doing it. So try not to put them in a box. Try not to give them all these labels or, you know, use manipulative behaviors around them. Try to figure it out. Figure out your own reaction and have a conversation with them about it.
Right.
That was my motivation for writing the book.
Right.
So that's why there's a thrust in that direction. I remembered what I'd forgotten before.
Okay.
I wanted to say, one of the things that I think leads to us having numerous addictions is that the consequences of not having them aren't laid on early enough. I mean, I think there were some benefits to having parents requiring you to say please and thank you and the basic courtesy that, you know, it used to be done 50 years ago with children, don't seem to be as prevalent today, and that a lot of people are growing up with the idea that they're in charge of themselves and what they do doesn't, nobody else, what they do is for them and it's up to them and it doesn't impact anybody. Other people's reaction is the other person's problem. There's sometimes that tone of, you know, if you have a problem with me, it's your problem, not mine. And sometimes I think that gets carried to extremes, and the consequence of, you know, living by that kind of a code doesn't get demonstrated. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah, and the reason that people are like that, quite perhaps, is because the parental training was not there as it was many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they think that if they've got a telephone in their hand, they can ignore their parents while they're punching numbers and sending texts and everything. And it's not the way that it used to be with technology. We're supposed to make it so that it serves us. But what I'm seeing is that more and more we are being the slave to the devices, to the technology, and they are controlling our thoughts and actions and behaviors.
I
see people into their telephone so much that they would run into people because they're not aware what's going on in the world around them.
Uh-huh.
Same thing in cars. And so you just have to say that being aware of your environment is a very important thing to learn, and it is something that's going to differentiate you with most of the other people who have become a slave to technology and have become a technology addict, for example.
Or, you know, addicted to their phones or whatever. And there's a lot of reward to the texting process. I mean, I can understand why it is so fulfilling for so many. And yet, they can't really do it at work. It's hard to be productive if you're constantly checking your texts and talking to your friends. So a lot of places will outlaw that. And I think it's difficult for some people. But anyway, that's sort of where my head was going when I forgot what I was going to say, was this whole idea of the consequences of our behavior don't seem to, I mean, it seems like, without generalizing too much, that we're living in a culture where consequences have not been enforced, allowed, that there's a lot of protecting young people from things as they're growing up, or what, you know, my favorite thing is as a teacher, when I had students plagiarizing and flunking so that they weren't going to be able to graduate, the school told me to figure out what the child could do in order to graduate. And my response was, this child has broken the law and needs to have the let them walk through graduation, but they have to come back to summer school and repeat the class because they cheated, and that was not okay. And this was probably 30 years ago, and I'm sure it's just gotten even worse as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. That's just my opinion.
So today we're talking with Sarah Elliston. Her book is called Lessons from a Difficult Person. You can go to Amazon if you would like to read her book, or go over to her website to get more information. Sarah, tell us that website address.
It's sarahelliston.com. Sarah has an H. So Sarah Elliston, just as it sounds, all one word, .com. It'll be fun. I'd love to talk to people about it.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for being on the program today and helping us to have some insight in dealing with difficult people, and we're going to run into them every day of our lives, I would imagine.
And thanks for helping me think about, okay, I need to write a book for the people that perceive themselves as difficult.
Absolutely. And when you get that next book written, I hope you'll give me a call so we can do another program.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.